The Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June 25th, 2002. In the Koinonia Fireside Room this evening, our presenter's name is Esther Men. Today's session number is ME-E-2002-02, and it's titled Perspectives on the Land, Session 2, American Perspectives on the Land. Let's listen in. All right, hello everyone. Oh, we'll get started to try to keep to the schedule. My name is Esther Men, and I come here from Chicago, where I teach at the Lutheran School of Theology. And my area of expertise is Old Testament. So this is a little bit of an adventure into an area of interest, and I think an area that's important to Holden, the whole concept of the land. So this series is called Perspectives on the Land, and today we're going to be looking at American perspectives on the land. And what I'm planning is two parts, probably unequal parts, but the first part is going to concentrate on an example of a Native people's perspective on the land, the Lakota people's perspective on the land specifically, as a kind of a case study. And then the second part will be on 21st century Americans' perspectives on the land. And I'll be doing a couple of readings there and then asking you to reflect on your perspective on the land at the end. So this may seem like a jump to go from Deuteronomy, which we were studying last time we met, to the Americas and to the Lakotas, but I think you're going to see some similarity in that we're going to continue on the problematic of settling a settled land. That wonderful passage in Deuteronomy about the good land that the Lord was given to the Israelites, at the end, at the closing, we noticed that it was problematic in that it was not only a habitable land, but it was an inhabited land. And so that leaves us with a problem. And this cycle continues in our own country as well. So we're picking up on that dynamic. The native peoples of the Americas have been here for 20,000 years or 40,000 years, depending on whom you believe, probably coming from Asia over the Bering Straits. And there were 20 million or so inhabitants at the time that the Europeans came in the 15th century, 15th and 16th centuries. Of these, only 1 million were in what's now the United States and Canada. The majority were in Mexico, Central America, and South America. But they were there then and met Columbus in 1492. On the island of San Salvador, and of course he thought that he had come to India, so he gave them the name the Indians. And they met the English at Jamestown in 1607, met the Pilgrims at Plymouth in 1620, and so forth. And there were many instances of friendly relations, of meetings. So some of the most famous are of Pocahontas, Chief Powhatan's daughter, married the Jamestown colonist John Smith and then traveled with him back to England. Or in the case of the Plymouth colony, there's Squanto, who taught the colonists how to plant corn by using fish as fertilizer. Without Squanto and his advice, the colony may not have survived. And then, of course, there's that legend of the first Thanksgiving feast in 1621 at Plymouth, when both the native inhabitants and the colonists celebrated with all kinds of foods, especially cuisine of the Americas. Now, these friendly contacts did continue. So you have trade relations, you have instances of intermarriage. So our whole history hasn't been one of violent conquest throughout. So it's similar also to the last point that I was leading with you in the last session,
where in the Bible, in the book of Joshua, the dominant vision is of a total conquest by the Israelites, a systematic annihilation of all the peoples. But in reality, there were probably different ways that the Israelites settled in the land, some military action, but other instances of settling in uninhabited areas, intermarriage, even joining of local peoples to the Israelites and so forth. So we have that same kind of history, although what really does stand out when you look at some of the chronologies of particular peoples, such as the Lakota, what does predominate is the violence and the relocations and the taking away of lands. So it's a tragic history. And I wanted to bring it forward before us, before we turn to the situation in the Middle East, because I think we have to look at our own history and acknowledge what we've done before we're able really to look at another people and say, what you're doing is wrong, because we have done and in some ways continue to do the same kinds of things. So I just want to complicate our whole analysis of the Middle East by kind of shining the light on us a little bit. That doesn't mean that we still can't criticize what's going on there, but we should also be self-critical as well. So I thought I would begin then with an overview of a narrative of the Lakota people and their relationship with the land after the arrival of the Europeans, and specifically after the United States came into the picture. And I thought this narrative would dramatize the displacement of a native people with strong attachments to the land, especially for the Lakota people, the attachment to what they call Paha Sapa, or the Black Hills, as a sacred center. Now, this is a nice chronological progression to go first from the Lakota to the 21st century perspectives on the land. But in addition, as I mentioned before and repeating right here, that it reminds us of the similarities between the American experience and the Israelites moving into the good land in Deuteronomy. And this comparison is not one that I'm making for the first time, of course, but rather the European settlers from the colonial period, they made these kinds of comparisons too. So they thought of themselves as Israelites that had experienced an exodus from religious oppression, that were embarking on a great adventure in the American wilderness, that were settling into the promised land. So all these images from the Bible come to shape the American understanding of their relationship to a land that is already inhabited, and also their treatment of the indigenous peoples as well. Just a concrete illustration of how important this imagery was. As the founding fathers were considering the seal of the United States and what symbol to use, such greats as Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin chose seals that would pick up on the imagery of the Bible. In one case, we had Moses with his hands lifting as the Israelites crossed the Red Sea and the Egyptians drowning. And in another, it was Israel in the wilderness accompanied by the cloud and the pillar of fire. So this was really a strong, dominant image. And so Christianity's biblical legacy has shaped our understanding of our manifest destiny, our push to the west, to the Pacific, our displacement, our driving out of the, even systematically exterminating in some cases, the indigenous population. And so this is an embarrassing and horrific chapter in our own history of how we came to live on this land that we love very deeply. So let's start with a little bit about the Lakota, which are one of the Plains Indians, and those included the Apache, the Arapaho, Blackfeet, Cheyenne, Comanche, and the Lakota. And they became the Plains Indians really from the 1600s, after they got guns and horses from the Spanish. And that was really when it was possible to chase the buffalo and to live in the plains. Now, the Lakota then were newcomers to the Great Plains area, to the what came to be known as the Dakota Territory. And they displaced earlier inhabitants. So you have sort of layer upon layer here. So you have the Mandans and the Hidatsu and the Arikara that were there before, and they were replaced by the Lakota. Now, the Lakota had moved westward because they had been forced out by the Ojibwe, who had been pushed westward by the Europeans. And so you have this cycle here of movements. And it was the French, actually, that gave the Ojibwe the guns that they were able to use against the Lakota and drive them westward. And it was the Ojibwe word for cutthroat that the Europeans used. It was something like Sioux. So that's the term, the Sioux Indian. That was actually a kind of a corrupt form of the Ojibwe term for cutthroat that they used to describe their enemy that they were driving out. So it's very common, you know, the word Sioux is very, very common, but actually it's not the name that the people themselves give to themselves, which is the Lakota, but rather a name that was given by their enemies. Well, the Lakota were famous for their lifestyle, their use of the teepee, and their hunt of the buffalo with the horses. And they lived for about 200 years in the Midwest, in the Dakota Territory, before the United States expansion west. So they had these attachments of about 200 years to this relatively new lifestyle. But you can see it's several generations in the land. So now, what are some of the important events that we have? I'm going to start with the Louisiana Purchase here in 1803. I was going to write the names of all the events, but I didn't get to that point. But in 1803, we have the Louisiana Purchase, and in 1804, President Jefferson sends Lewis and Clark on his expedition westward. And he has given Lewis and Clark special instructions concerning the Sioux, because they're the largest group of the Plains Indian, and they control the Missouri River. And he says, don't get in any fights with them. They are the core of this vast trading empire that he imagines that will be created as the United States moves west. And so in this wonderful book, Undaunted Courage by Stephen Ambrose, there's an account of the encounter between Lewis and Clark and the Lakota at Yankton, South Dakota. And he gives, Lewis seems to be the spokesman through an interpreter, and he tells the Lakota, it's always called Sioux here, so I'll just go back and forth. I don't mean anything negative by it. He tells them that now there is one great father, a new great father, meaning Jefferson, that will do, that they can trust, and that will take care of them, and they should deal only with this great father, referring to the fact that now the French are out of the picture. And he gives five little medals to five chiefs, and he appoints one of them the head chief and so forth. And they ask for gunpowder and guns, but they don't give them any of that. So the Sioux were not impressed. Jefferson wanted them, Lewis and Clark, to impress the Sioux, but they were not impressed. And in fact, at one point, there's almost a battle, but they refrain. And Ambrose suggests that maybe if there had been a battle at this initial point, and the Sioux had become enemies to the expansion. They still could have gotten guns from the French and so forth, and they may have actually become part of Canada. They did control the Missouri and so forth. It could have really altered American history. But anyway, that didn't happen. But the Sioux were not given a positive evaluation in the summary, which Lewis and Clark wrote. They characterized all the tribes. Of the Teton Sioux, they said, these are the vilest miscreants of a savage race and must ever remain the pirates of the Missouri until such measures are pursued by our government as will make them feel a dependence on its will for their supply of merchandise. So they realized that there was an independent spirit here and that it had to be brought to its knees if there was going to be any advance, but even at that early date. So Lakota remained very strong in this region, and there were battles, and in some cases the Lakota won. For example, in 1866, Black Elk, in this book Black Elk Speaks, that was written by John Neihardt, who interviewed this Oglala Sioux holy man, Black Elk. Black Elk recounts a battle in 1866 in which he calls it the Battle of the 100 Slain, where the warriors had defeated 100 U.S. military personnel. And it was quite a great victory, but he learns later that 100 slain was nothing, you know, in comparison to the number that were coming. So what I've done is I've kind of excerpted or indicated passages in Black Elk Speaks that correspond to some of the big events. And I've also selected them with an eye to passages that refer to the land and attitudes and so forth towards the land. Before I read this passage, I should say that shortly after, in this period, after all these skirmishes, in 1868, a treaty was made. It was the Fort Laramie Treaties. And this treaty was with the Sioux people, and it was for the establishment of a Great Sioux Reservation, which included South Dakota, Nebraska, Montana. It was a huge area, including Pajasapa, the Black Hills. And this was in response to all of these very aggressive and successful battles that the Indians were conducting against the military and against settlers. And specifically, there were a number of attacks on the Bozeman Trail, which the U.S. government wanted to stop. And so this Fort Laramie Treaty, the Lakota were promised absolute and undisturbed use and occupation of the Great Sioux Reservation. But let me read you a little from Black Elk Speaks now about, he's reflecting on the 1866 Battle of 100 Slain, which happened when he was quite a young man. When I was older, I learned what the fighting was about that winter and next summer. Up on the Madison Fork, the Wisichus, does somebody know how to pronounce that better? That's their term for the white man, but it doesn't have anything to do with white, so I don't know the term. I'm going to pronounce it Wisichus unless somebody knows. Okay.
I've read it, but I just said the whoop.
The Wisichus had found much of the yellow metal that they worship and that makes them crazy, and they wanted to have a road up through our country to the place where the yellow metal was, but my people did not want the road. It would scare the bison and make them go away, and would also let the other Wisichus come in like a river. They told us that they wanted only to use a little land, as much as a wagon would take between the wheels, but our people knew better. And when you look about you now, you can see what it was they wanted. Once we were happy in our own country, and we were seldom hungry, for then the two-leggeds and the four-leggeds lived together like relatives, and there was plenty for them and for us. But the Wisichus came, and they have made little islands for us, and other little islands for the four-leggeds, and always these islands are becoming smaller, for around them surges the gnawing flood of the Wisichu, and it is dirty with lies and greed. A long time ago, my father told me what his father told him, that there was once a Lakota holy man called Drinkswater who dreamed what was to be, and this was long before the coming of the Wisichus. He dreamed that the four-leggeds were going back into the earth, and that a strange race had woven a spider's web all around the Lakotas. And he said, when this happens, you shall live in square gray houses in a barren land, and beside those square gray houses you shall starve. They say he went back to Mother Earth soon after he saw this vision, and it was sorrow that killed him. You can look about you now and see that he meant these dirt-roofed houses we are living in, and that all the rest was true. Sometimes dreams are wiser than waking. Well, so his reflections on all the creatures and so forth living in harmony and plenty before the creation of the islands or the reservations. Okay, so let me just go on here and say that by 1877, now notice that's less than 10 years later, the Black Hills, Ahasapa, that sacred land to the Lakota, was reclaimed. And in exchange, the Lakota were promised all aid necessary for civilization. So they were promised cattle, they were promised other supplies. But the Black Hills were taken away. And why did this happen? Well, it was because of this greed for the gold, and Custer had been one of the military officers who had known that there was gold and was spreading reports, and there were many miners that came in, sent into the area. So there was this interest in this land because of the mine. So now we have another connection to the Holden and to Deuteronomy. So see, there are some common themes. These natural resources that people need to live were taken away. So I have a short reading here also. Having to do with the going back on the promise concerning the Black Hills. It's called the Black Hills Act. Wherever we went, the soldiers came to kill us, and it was all our own country. It was ours already when the Wisichus made the treaty with Red Cloud that said it would be ours as long as grass should grow and water flow. That was only 8 winters before, and they were chasing us now because we remembered and they forgot. After that, we started west again, and we were not happy anymore because so many of our people had untied their horses' tails. Apparently, that means that they're not going to war anymore. They're not going to fight anymore. And had gone over to the Wisichus. We went back deep into our country, and most of the land was black from the fire, and the bison had gone away. We camped on the Tongue River, where there was some cottonwood for the ponies, and a hard winter came on early. It snowed much, game was hard to find, and it was a hungry time for us. News came to us there in the moon of the falling leaves, which is November, that the Black Hills had been sold to the Wisichus, and also all the country west of the hills, the country we were in then. I learned when I was older that our people did not want to do this. The Wisichus went to some of the chiefs alone and got them to put their marks on the treaty. Maybe some of them did this when they were crazy from drinking the Minnewaukan, or holy water, the Wisichus gave them. I have heard this, I do not know, but only crazy or very foolish men will sell their Mother Earth. Sometimes I think it might have been better if we had stayed together and made them kill us all. It's a very strong statement there. Only crazy men sell their Mother Earth. Yes, it does going back and forth between different things, it does seem that about 50% of the Lakota were north on a hunting trip, and there's just a very small number that were talking with the whites. Well, I'll go on to a few other things. Now, once the people were, the Lakota were settled into these reservations, the official policy shifted from extermination to assimilation. And so the desire was to have the Lakota stop their traditional way of life of hunting bison and to settle down and to be farmers. So to kind of fit into the dominant culture. And so
Well, what caused this shift between from extermination to assimilation?
Well, the people had all been moved onto certain lands, and so they were no longer a threat to the settlers or to any of the other missions and projects of the United States. So that's at the point. Mm-hmm. It may have been conscience, you know, but anyway, so in 1883, we have the killing of the last bison, and Black Elk talks about that as well. He's talking about 1883. It was the summer of his 20th year, and he performed a ceremony of the elk. He was a holy man, and so it describes a lot of his the rituals that he was involved in as well. That fall, they say, the last of the bison herds were slaughtered by the Wisichus. I can remember when the bison were so many that they could not be counted, but more and more Wisichus came to kill them until there were only heaps of bones scattered where they used to be. The Wisichus did not kill them to eat. They killed them for the metal that makes them crazy, and they took only the hides to sell. Sometimes they did not even take the hides, only the tongues. And I've heard that fireboats came down the Missouri loaded with dried bison tongues. You can see that the men who did this were crazy. Sometimes they did not even take the tongues. They just killed and killed because they liked to do that. When we hunted bison, we killed only what we needed. And when there was nothing left but heaps of bones, the Wisichus came and gathered up even the bones and sold them. Now, in 1887, this was after the bison were all killed in 1883, so things are moving fast. 1887, we have something called the Dawes Act. And as I'm looking at this, I'm thinking, you know, I think my ancestors, I had ancestors in western South Dakota. My both my grandparents' parents lived there. I think they came in under this. What the Dawes Act was it divided the reservation, the Indian lands, into 160 acres, and it gave each man this parcel of 160 acres. This didn't happen in Pine Ridge until 1902, but in 1887, the other areas, this was happening. So what happens is that there was so much land that there was a lot left over, and so that was made available. It was declared surplus and open to white settlement at 50 cents an acre. So there was this move to force the Lakota to be farmers, and then they don't need all this land. So in 1889, then, after the Dawes Act, there was something called the Sioux Act, which divided the Great Sioux Nation, this big territory, into six islands, and once again declared the surplus open to white settlement. Now we have, instead of one great stretch, we have these six, this is six part of six islands, so-called islands.
So is that some of what we still have, like Minnesota?
I wish I had a map that would show us sort of the history of this. That would really make it more alive to me as well. But yes, that's the beginning of the reservations that are scattered with white or European towns and settlements all around,
mm-hmm.
instead of one great territory.
Okay, now I have a little reading here from Black Elk on how the islands are getting smaller.
There was hunger, this was in 1889, there was hunger among my people before I went across the big water because the Wisichus did not give us all the food they promised in the Black Hills Treaty. Remember the Black Hills Treaty, they were supposed to supply all that is necessary,
right?
They made that treaty themselves. Our people did not want it and did not make it, yet the Wisichus who made it had given us less than half as much as they had promised. So the people were hungry before I went away. But it was worse when I came back. Oh, in the meantime, he had gone over to Europe. And this is just fascinating, with Buffalo Bill's Wild West. So there's things about him traveling in Europe and how he loved the Queen of England because they call him grandmother and so forth. Because she said, if you were my people, I would not make you dress up like this and dance for strangers. And they loved her. But anyway, so he came back and things were worse. But my people looked pitiful. There was a big drought. The rivers and creeks seemed to be dying. Nothing would grow that the people had planted, and the Wisichus had been sending less cattle and other food than ever before. The Wisichus had slaughtered all the bison and shut us up in pens. It looked as though we might starve to death. We could not eat lies, and there was nothing we could do. And now the Wisichus had made another treaty to take away from us about half the land we had left. That was with this. Our people did not want this treaty either, but the Three Stars, that was his word for General Crook. That's a pretty good name for him, isn't it? C-R-O-O-K, C-R-O-O-K, who headed the commission that arranged the treaty of 1889. The Three Stars came and made the treaty just the same because the Wisichus wanted our land between Smoky Earth and the Good River. So the flood of Wisichus, dirty with bad deeds, gnawed away half of the island that was left to us. When Three Stars came to kill us on Rosebud, Crazy Horse whipped him and drove him back. But when he came this time without any soldiers, he whipped us and drove us back. We were penned up and could do nothing. All the time I was away from home across the big water, my powers were gone and I was almost like a dead man moving around most of the time. And it goes on. This was the time when you have the appearance of the ghost dances, which was a kind of apocalyptic movement, a dance that was envisioning the return of the buffalo and the way of life. It was really kind of a desperate situation and a ritual response to that. Instead of fighting, it was kind of a religious response to that. In 1890, then, we have the Battle of Wounded Knee, which Black Elk says was triggered when the whites attempted to disarm the Lakota. And at the Battle of Wounded Knee, about 350 men, women, and children were killed. And he writes at some length about that. I won't read that just because it's too long, but he comments that the women and children, that they had done nothing. It was just gratuitous killing. Yeah, it's quite a graphic description. He says, he has this really graphic description of the killing and so forth, and then at the end he says, "It was a good winter day when all this happened. The sun was shining. But after the soldiers marched away from their dirty work, a heavy snow began to fall. The wind came up in the night. There was a big blizzard, and it grew very cold. The snow drifted deep in the crooked gulch, and it was one long grave of butchered women and babies and children who had never done any harm and were only trying to run away." So that's that book called Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. That was had to do with the massacre here in 1890. 90. Now, that's all from Black Elk, except that he does have some other wonderful symbolism of how everything an Indian does is in a circle, because the power of the world always works in circles. So this is kind of more of a philosophical or religious statement that he has. Everything tries to be round. And in the old days, when we were strong and happy, all our power came to us from the sacred hoop of the nation. And as so long as the hoop was unbroken, the people flourished. The flowering tree was the living center of the hoop, and the circle of the four quarters nourished it. The east gave peace and light. The south gave warmth. The west gave rain. The north, with its cold and mighty wind, gave strength and endurance. This knowledge came to us from the outer world with our religion. Everything the power of the world does is done in a circle. The sky is round, and I have heard that the earth is round like a ball, and so are all the stars. The wind in its greatest power whirls. Birds make their nests in circles, for theirs is the same religion as ours. The sun comes forth and goes down again in a circle. The moon does the same, and both are round. Even the seasons form a great circle in their changing and always come back again to where they were. The life of a man is a circle, from childhood to childhood, and so it is in everything where power moves. Our teepees were round like the nests of birds, and these were always set in a circle, the nation's hoop, a nest of many nests where the Great Spirit meant for us to hatch our children. But the Wisichus have put us in these square boxes. Our power is gone and we are dying, for the power is not in us anymore. You can look at our boys and see how it is with us. When we were living by the power of the circle, in the way we should, boys were men at 12 or 13 years of age, but now it takes much longer to mature. Well, it is as it is. We are prisoners of war while we are waiting here, but there is another world. So even in the description of the circles, you have those four cardinal spaces, you know, with the tree in the middle and the bird's nests and...
Tree life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I have to leave Black Elk now because he only writes about this period of time. But if you ever have a chance, you know, to go over that again, it's really powerful because it's such a transitional period. I'm going to just summarize briefly now that the chipping away of the land that was so important to the Lakota continued all through even the next century. So in the time frame of the First World War, the leasing of land to non-Indians continued to be a primary income. So there was a movement away from the raising of lands of livestock to leasing of land to whites. So less and less land was actually inhabited by the Lakota. And eventually the mineral rights to the land was retained by the government as well. Now this is really important because you have both the gold and you have uranium now, which is worth like $8 billion or so. So once again, it's minerals that come to the fore there. Oh, other things that happened were in 1924 there was an Indian Citizen Act where the Lakotas became U.S. citizens and not citizens of their own nation. In 1934, there was the Indian Reorganization Act, and it had a good impulse. It was trying to stop some of this leasing and damage caused, but a lot of the loyalties and bonds that had held people together had already been destroyed, and the Indian Reorganization Act also established tribal councils that were different from the traditional leadership, and so all that had good intentions. There were also some negative things.
So what was the year they were made citizens of U.S.?
1924. Mm-hmm. Now, after World War II, there was once again an attempt to assimilate unused land, so to make it easier to lease, to kind of make it more efficient. And right now, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which was responsible for that, is being sued for $2.4 billion of trust money that's unaccounted for from this leasing of land. So it just looks like a tremendous corruption.
Wonder of wonders, huh?
Yeah.
But we have given them casinos.
They give us casinos.
That's about all that there's room for in the land.
In the land they have, yeah. In the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, relocation programs came to the fore to try, once again, to try to assimilate the Lakota into the dominant culture. And a lot of people moved off the reservations with the lure of economic prosperity in the cities, which often didn't materialize. And then in the 60s and 70s, there were cluster housing programs where, in order to kind of economize on utilities, they put houses together, which freed up a lot of those larger plots again, which it sort of severed some of the remaining connections of the people to the traditional lands that they had known also, right? And some of the social connections that you have, you know, by moving people together. And this new land was freed for white ranchers. And this is happening in the 60s and 70s. Currently, Pine Ridge Reservation is about 3 million acres. It's down from 30 million acres at this point. So it's just a tenth of its size. So then this has happened in the last 100 years.
Was it at the point of when the Indians were being discouraged from migrating or moving about, was that the point at which the government instituted government schools and
yes, I don't exactly know what point that is, but it's with that effort to assimilate.
Mm-hmm. It was in the late 1800s up until 2030, somewhere.
Pretty long.
They were taken into boarding schools, and they were forbidden to use their language or culture or anything.
Yeah, it looks like, with this Dawes Act, settling people on 160 acres and so forth, just trying to make the Lakota fit into the larger culture, that this would be the time that you would have it. But I don't have that specific information. I know that was a practice. Now, in 1973, there was a protest, right, with Wounded Knee. At Wounded Knee, there was an occupation of Wounded Knee and really some armed confrontation by the militant American Indian movement, and it was a reaffirmation of self-determination, and they put out a statement that declared their intention to remain independent.
Now, one of the directors here was at Wounded Knee, Paul Bowe,
right,
and was jailed then, wasn't he?
He did a lock for him at Pine Ridge, and I remember when he died, which was rather recent, he'd been here, the Indians came to they respected him so much because he tried to help them. They came to his funeral. But he was one who was for them and worked with the government and trying to get as much help as he could.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, boy. Well, it's a long story. That's very interesting, bit of connection. And he's not here right now, though.
He's entering the
a couple of last things. In 1977, the United States offers $17.3 million for the Black Hills. $17.3 million for the Black Hills. This was its value in 1877 when it was taken away. And that was rejected. Then in 1980, there's another offer for $102 million for the Black Hills also rejected. So the policy of the Lakota is to reject any land for money for land, because that's not the issue. And in the 1990s, the tribes continued to refuse these settlement offers. There are still dockets pending. Honeywell, which had mineral rights to uranium, has given has returned 1,000 acres to the Lakota. And there's something going on that, starting in 1990, there was a protest of transfer of 200,000 acres, the banks of the Missouri, to the South Dakota government. There were some issues involving a dam and wildlife preservation and so forth. And so there was a protest at an island in the Missouri, La Framboise Island. Does somebody know how to say that better? La Framboise.
Framboise.
Is that how you say it? Because there are often American ways of pronouncing those fresh framboise. Thank you. So just a short short overview, took a little longer than I thought. A study of one people's struggle to maintain its ties with the land, and not only the land, which is a resource for survival and for prosperity, but also lands that have sacred significance, the Black Hills, and also lands that are that the dwellers there form the social structures that are so important for the people. Now, this history and other histories that you probably are aware of in your own parts of the country places us in an ambiguous situation with in relation to this beautiful and abundant land that we love. But it also sets the scene, as I said, for the next two sessions on the situation in Israel and Palestine, because a lot of this kind of honeycombing of the peoples in small areas is similar to what's happening to the West Bank and to the Gaza as well. All right, so I should ask for any heartfelt reactions or comments at this time before I turn briefly to a couple of observations and passages concerning our relationship to land.
When you travel or drive, you go through all this. Here from where I live and all the way across the Dakotas, you can stop at Lakota, Mandan, you know, and you see all of them from Lewis and Clark. So there at least there are places to mark the history of what we've done, taken advantage. And you see the teepees and what little space they have. You know, they take more and more. They've done it even around Lake Chelan. You know, there was a place, Walter Point, was where the wigwams were and so forth. You know, now they have people go in and settle there. So it's taken, another place they've taken away from them. And I live on the Mississippi and in Illinois, and Blackhawk was very important, and we're buried in the cemetery there. We have powwows every year on, you know, sort of thing. But makes you aware of what we've done to them. So I was wondering, when did they start making the coins with the Indian head on? You know, the Kennedys.
The 1800s.
Right.
I don't know when they started, but it's on them. And there's some, you know, we name a lot of athletic teams by the names, and some of them reject that. You know, we try to say we're honoring them. They don't feel that.
Actually, they see it as making fun of them.
Yeah.
That's probably closer to
their high
school. High school. It's okay.
Thank you.
But
there's technology
that, I mean, we Europeans have done dreadful things to the Native people. At this point, what does anybody think is an answer? I mean, how do we remedy that?
I think there's really positive things happening in some places where Native peoples are reclaiming their traditions, reviving them, and so forth. And I think if we can support those, that's a very positive thing.
Right. But hard to get the land back.
Get the land, yeah.
Yeah, it's the issue of the land. That's now. has other
There's
uses.
No solution to that at all. That's gone. I think there's so much politics involved, both from the Native American side and the American side. And if you can beat that, then you've got a solution.
Well, the government is now being investigated through the Indian Agency.
Oh, the Bureau.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs. It's being investigated for misuse of Indian funds, which amounts to enormous amounts of money.
Aren't they reclaiming some of the stuff in Oklahoma that we've begun to use for oil and stuff? And the Indians are battling this.
Oklahoma, in Maine, in Oregon. I don't know if somebody told me about a sort of kind of a land swap or something that's happening in Oregon. I haven't been able to find out any further information about it, but some deal is being worked on.
I always have this real struggle in me because there's the part of me that is very much angry at what has happened to the Native American. Then there's the other part of me that says, the Native Americans were doing it to each other also. Now, I don't see the Lakota Sioux offering to give back the land that they took from another Native tribe. So I can get really bogged down with what is history and, what do I say, natural history in the sense that, unfortunately, it's become natural because war and taking over other people's land has become part of life, whether we like it or not. And if you go back into history in Europe, if you go back into history in any culture, it's been a history of land grabbing. And so I don't know where it stops, I don't know how to stop it, and I don't know how far back you can go in repatriation. Mm-hmm. And we have the same thing with blacks, African Americans, and how far, I don't know the answer. Mm-hmm. But I guess you're getting a lot of confusion about thinking about it. Mm-hmm.
The thing is, we had these written treaties.
Well, that's true. That most of which we just trashed them, you know.
That's really true.
And to me, it doesn't even happen on quite such a scale internationally.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty amazing.
Israel's doing a pretty good job.
Now, we could remain here, or I have a reading from Dakota by Kathleen Norris, and she talks a little bit about coming back to South Dakota, and it kind of interweaves some of the issues of, you know, the Lakota's presence in the land and so forth, and her own family's settlement there, and so perhaps. If you don't mind, I'll read that and complicate things further, because she's writing a spiritual geography, and I'm always optimistic. I thought maybe we could do that while we were here, but I see I'll just have a chance to read a little bit of hers, so let me do that. She moved back to Lemon, South Dakota.
Yeah, Lemon.
From Manhattan, and this was because of an inheritance, and no one else, none of our other siblings wanted to go back and claim the family dwelling. So, Lemon, South Dakota is here because in 1908, the United States government, responding to pressures that had been building since the 1860s, opened up the last piece of Indian territory on the Standing Rock Reservation to homesteaders. Now, I didn't even get a 1908 in there, so this was keeping on going. So they opened up in 1908 the last piece of Indian territory on Standing Rock Reservation to homesteaders, and the Milwaukee Road pushed west with a railroad line to accommodate them. In 1907, Lemon was a tent city for railroad workers, but the town soon had wooden sidewalks, churches, a school, and businesses for farmers, attracted by the railroad's promotion of a mythical land of opportunity. Agronomists predicted that rain would kill the plow.
Sorry.
The ethnic makeup of the area still reflects the fact that the Milwaukee Road, advertised heavily in Scandinavia, While about 50 miles to the north, the Great Northern attracted settlers from Germany, as well as Germans who had farmed since the time of Catherine the Great in South Russia. German can still be heard on the streets of New Leipzig, North Dakota, where only a radical nonconformist would hang out laundry on any day but Monday. The Native American population is still concentrated to the east and south of Lemon around McLaughlin and Faith. Frontier has all too often been romanticized in American cultures by movies and novels, glorifying the violent and often ugly code of the West. The fact that one people's frontier is another's homeland has mostly been overlooked. I'll read that one again. I thought that was really pretty good. The fact that one people's frontier is usually another's homeland has often been mostly overlooked. The names of the first inhabitants of Western Dakota are lost to us. Descendants of the Mandans moved west from the Mississippi Valley early in the 14th century. They were followed in the early 17th century by the Hidatsu, who came from Western Minnesota, and the Arikara, who came up the Missouri from Nebraska.
That's Arikara.
Thank you. Arikara.
Arikara.
Arikara. Thank you. Please jump in to help me. It's like reading the Bible sometimes, right? These three tribes formed what the historian Elwin Robinson called the distinctive culture of Western Dakota, that of agricultural villages along the Missouri. They were all but wiped out in the mid-18th century by the nomadic Dakota, nicknamed Sioux by whites, who were pushed onto the plains from Wisconsin and Minnesota by the more numerous Ojibwe, who had obtained guns from French traders. More whites followed the U.S. Army posts. The late 19th century brought the Black Hills Rush, Gold Rush, and ranchers who seized vast tracts of native hunting lands for grazing, and who were later displaced by homesteaders. Now, as today's farmers and ranchers are being driven off the land, and there's talk of using the Dakotas as a national garbage dump or a Buffalo Commons, I've come to think that one thing that distinguishes a frontier is the precarious nature of the human hold on it. The severe climate of Dakota forces us to see that no one can control this land. The largeness of land and sky is humbling, putting humankind in proper perspective. One friend, Jim Lane, has described what it's like to walk here. One night I sensed not only the curvature of the earth, but its size and gravitational pull. This feeling is no doubt what holds people to the prairie, what leaves prairie people to feel claustrophobic in more cluttered environs, with their trees and mountains and tall buildings obscuring our view, our sense of planet. This sense of planet allows Dakotans to feel as if they are in the middle of the world, rather than, as others would have it, in the middle of nowhere. It also suggests to me the truth of what Native American writer Paula Gunn Allen said in a recent interview, that the longer Europeans remain in America, the more Indian they will become. What makes an Indian, she explained, is a deep connection to the land, built over generations, that imbues their psychology and eventually their spirituality and makes them one with the spirit of the land. While this comment is vulnerable to a simplistic interpretation, and Dakotans grow weary of tourists claiming to be one with the land, let alone Indian at heart after week-long camping trips in the Black Hills, Allen touches on a deep truth. The spirit of the land is not an abstraction in Western Dakota, but a real presence. For people like the young white rancher I know, a third-generation Dakotan who says, "The land lives," I wonder if what Allen suggests isn't already happening. I wonder if this process is what gives me the nerve to lay claim on my spiritual geography. And she goes on to say that she doesn't think that she has any claim to be Indian, and she says that it's an insult to the Native Americans to have middle-class Americans try to appropriate their spirituality after they've given up their own. But I'll just read you one last paragraph here. Conversion means starting with who we are, not who we wish we were. It means knowing where we come from. It means taking to heart the words of Native American writer Andy Smith, who writes in Ms. Magazine, "A true medicine woman would advise a white woman to look into her own culture and find what is liberating in it." And this is what I hope I have done, beginning with my move back to Dakota. My path of conversion may have a few elements of Indianness because of the spirits of the land where I live, and because I understand that my faith comes from my grandmother's. It was in moving back to the plains that I found my old ones, my flesh and blood ancestors, as well as the desert monks and mystics of the Christian church. Dakota is where it all comes together, and surely that is one definition of the sacred. And she goes on to talk about how influential the Benedictine community is for her in South Dakota, and how she came back to the church, her Christian roots, through moving back to South Dakota. But I just thought this passage fit in so well with the discussion of Black Elk and that experience there. If we had had time, I would have asked you to think for yourself, if you have a center of your spiritual geography. Black Elk and his people have the Black Hills, and Lemon, South Dakota, is now Kathleen Norris's. So I was going to ask you to reflect if you had a spiritual geography with a center in it, and then to think, is where you live now different from that center? And then I was going to ask you to map, kind of create a chart that would map kind of your spiritual geography to represent it in line and so forth. And then to discuss what is our connection to the land as Americans here now. So if you have time, some time to just think about those issues, I'd be fascinated to hear what you come up with. But
I just have, this has nothing to do with Indians, but maybe it's through the U.S. government, maybe it's the economy that's doing this to our land. I mean, we come from North Austin, and I'll tell you, in the 10 years we lived there, you talk about the land disappearing. It is, and Barbara, you can attest, it's just disappearing. I mean, everywhere you look, there's concrete, there's houses, there's apartments.
And huge houses.
And I mean, the natural land is disappearing and just being eaten up. It's like a giant monster. Along with it, the traffic, the pollution from the fumes, it just gives me chills. It's scary. It is scary.
So I think fewer and fewer people are going to feel attached to a farm or a piece of land.
Well, what's it doing, period, to the overall?
In our state, too. It's being hurt. The farmland's being sold for housing.
And the wetlands all disappearing. No, they come in, Walmart comes in, takes over and builds them. It's crazy. Wildlife's all disappearing around you, Bruce. And we just let all them come in and take over.
Kathleen Norris has another book, Amazing Grace, where she extols Manhattan as her connection to Manhattan, as an American. So we tend to think of our connection with the land as to agricultural land or to settled land, but she goes both ways. Goes back to South Dakota, but also celebrates the city, and I have a nice poem by Carl Sandburg that does the same. So our attachment, our spiritual geography may include cities as well. Well, I need to let you go, but it's been a delight, and thank you very much.
Could you say briefly where you're headed in terms of Deuteronomy, where we started?
Okay, so where we're headed now is next time we'll be looking at, we'll be understanding Jewish, American Jewish and Israeli perspectives on the land, especially of Israel. And so that'll be tomorrow at 10:45. Then I take a break on Thursday. And then on Friday, there's another session on understanding Palestinian perspectives on the land. And then the final date is Christian perspectives on the land, looking at what the Christian tradition offers as resources for understanding the land and treating the land. All right, thank you.
Thank you.